Accession number 28651, Mr. Victor Barrack, Reel 8. Now, tell me, you've got these instructors and you're down in this camp near Cairo to train the Basutoland gunners. How did the training process go? It sounds quite a difficult process.
Well, it's all done through the interpreter. And these men are only going to be used as actual gun numbers, not for command post crew at all, purely as gun numbers, mainly in humping ammunition. Although the more intelligent ones were going to be trained as gun layers on the actual guns themselves and operating the fuse equipment.
And how did they take to gun drill?
Very well. Oh, yes. Their only gripe was the fact that, of course, their rations were different from the British. They were fed what they call mealy meal, which is a millet, which was made into a form of porridge, a very thick porridge, and they had tea, and they only had meat once a week. But when they realised the difference of their rations, they wanted to know why. But we didn't have any sort of mutiny at all about it. But they used to make their porridge and then pour the tea into it and mix the whole lot up.
So what happened next? So how, you were training them?
Yeah, so we finished the training course, actually. One thing which did strike me was the fact that we were working in very, very strong sunlight, that even black people suffer from sunburn. And I realised that some of these chaps were blistering and they had to cover up, because something which one would never think about, but the fact they did actually blister in the sun. Of course, everybody's working with bare tops, so hot.
Now, what happened next then?
Right, so I'm finished training, and by train back to Beirut.
And taking them with you?
Yes, and allocated 40 to one troop and 40 to my troop. And I had Sergeant McCabe that came with me, who had been very useful for the in the interpreting.
Now, was it successful in a climate, sort of getting them into the unit to sort of
Yes, apart? Yes, they assimilated very well, really. The British troops did seem to feel that the fact that they didn't understand English and so forth, that they got away with little, what we say, military infringements, which wouldn't have occurred if it had been a white man. But that was accepted. But they fitted in very well, really.
So what happens next, then?
Right. That was at Haifa, wasn't it?
Right about then. Yeah. You weren't quite sure.
No, next thing we were due to move to Alexandria in Egypt, north of Cairo.
And this is into 1943 or 4, would it be?
43.
And what happened?
43, early 44. I think. Yeah. Yes, of course we had Christmas 42 up in Tripoli. Christmas 43 could have been in Haifa. Yes, it was
44. Now, so the North African campaign had finished by then. What were you doing at Alexandria? Were you just guarding the port?
No, it hadn't finished. No. Al-Alamein, that had happened, but North Africa was still in being, still ongoing, I think. I'm not sure. But
well, the invasion of Italy's Sicily's July 43. The invasion of Italy's July and September 43.
So it would have been, you're right. No, it was mainly still port defence, and we had a quiet time there. Of course, I took over four guns on the western side of the harbour. It's a huge harbour.
3.7s again, is it? Yep, nearly always 3.7s.
Yeah, 3.7s. On the parade ground of what was the Egyptian Sea Defence Force. Marines. They were Marines who had some large guns to protect the harbour, in charge of a very, very big, very black Sudanese colonel who used to come down without permission to have his troops on parade on their parade ground where our guns were. And he was a real disciplinarian. All came down horseback. And any man in the lines who was inspecting not being up to scratch, he would swing the horse around, so his backside horse knocked this chap for six. We got to know him, actually, and I went up with another officer and made himself known and in his mess. And he had a whole range of photographs of bands, because they had a very fine band, these Marines did. And they used to play all the British tunes, Scottish tunes, Bonnie Scotland and Bluebells. And so I asked him, what about these bands? I always said we had British bandmasters. And of course, they only used British tunes to train their bands. But we were there for a little time, then eventually...
But you weren't in action there?
No.
What happened next?
Next thing is we moved to Italy. Toronto.
And what was the situation there?
The fighting had moved well to the north then.
So this is 44, yeah.
Yeah. And so we just went there as port defence. Wasn't there very, very long when we were disbanded. We took over 3.7s at Toronto.
So no raids, no nothing there.
No.
What was the state of the harbour?
That was a mess. It really was, because we saw the results of that wonderful naval assault made by Fairey Swordfish torpedo bombers. And they sank, I think, two very big battleships, or the naval ships in the harbour. Of course, the Taranto harbour is in two harbours. The Mali Piccolo and the Mali Grande was the big one, which was a natural harbour. And there were these damaged ships just lying on the bottom there. They made a mess of it.
How did you get on with the Italians, civilians?
Very well. Yes, they were very friendly.
Did they offer you any hospitality or anything? Or was it just friendly?
Nothing at all. We were treated as equals, you know, friends, not a sort of an occupying force.
No, I'm sorry, you missed hospitality.
No, it was a very poor area, very poor, and so you got the feeling that they were having to live on very, very meagre sort of fare and so forth. And of course, a lot of the interland was fairly agricultural.
So it's just they were just friendly.
Yeah.
Now tell me about the disbandment of the unit. How did this? Why was the unit disbanded?
Well, we disbanded because there was no air activity. We had air superiority. Our air force now had command of the skies, certainly down south where we were. And I think they wanted the manpower for the infantry.
Now, do you know when you were disbanded? I just wondered if you might remember that.
No, I can't.
So just 1944.
It was towards the end of... Yeah, it must have been probably the autumn of 44. Yeah.
Now, what happened to you then? Because you were disbanded.
We were disbanded. The troops were, I think, yes, the whole unit was moved back to the Middle East for training, for conversion. There wasn't the actual training facilities there. It's sort of in situ in Italy. They moved the whole unit back to the Middle East. I was sent to another officer to Acre, A-C-R-E, north of Bay of Haifa, where there was a barracks, Sydney Smith Barracks, which was a special officer conversion course in force there, and it covered everything. It was a very, very good course, actually, because we had tanks, we worked with tanks, we worked with machine gun, backup mortar, large mortars, did all sorts of train night exercises, climb up mountains, not mountain, up hilly areas, where we had a reconnaissance party who would go out beforehand and would lay a white tape in the dark. The troops had to follow this white tape to get to the actual assault position. It was quite an experience there. Also, hand grenade training. There was something here which was a bit hairy. It was the throwing of live grenades. The setup was that you had in the grenade area three pits, or three, they call them bays, three bays. It was like a bit like a cloverleaf. So you've got four dug in sandbags, which was the throwing bay. Then here you had the assembly bay on this left, and over here you had the priming bay. So in the assembly bay, I forget how many, but what many of us, probably half a dozen if it's outside, where we were each given a grenade, wasn't primed. Then went through singly into the priming bay, where the sergeant, and they gave you the grenade and show you how you took out the base of the grenade, put the primer in, and screw it back on. It's now ready for throwing. And then when ready for throwing, you went into the throwing bay. And on this occasion, the Lieutenant Sawyer, I remember him very well now, was going to throw, and it was the actual method of the throw was a lob, really, over arm. So we've got a high trajectory, so that it would fall probably into an enclosed position, but beyond, to open ground. And this chap Sawyer gave his lob, and he let go too soon. Instead of the grenade going forward, it sailed up in the air above us. The thing was, where's it going to land? No prime. Of course, you see, when you throw it, you let go of the clip, pull the pin out, let go of the clip, which then you had either a 4 or 7 second fuse. I'm not sure whether it was 7 second. It sailed up in the air, and where's it going? It's going into the priming bay next there, which it didn't. The sergeant and Lieutenant Collins were there. They thought it was going to land in there. They hopped out of the pit onto the bank above, but it didn't go in the pit. It landed on the bank above them. The sergeant managed to slide back in, but Collins caught the full whack, and I don't know what happened to him. We rushed him to the hospital and straight away. He caught the full blast of the grenade, but that just a little disconcerting, even in training. Yeah.
Anything else about the training course at Sydney Smith Barracks?
No, not really.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh yes, but it was hard work because I was a brain gunner, so carrying a 23-pound brain gun on your shoulders, and with an assistant who would carry the ammunition. It was a bit tough with the heat, you know. And also, one doesn't realise what a prickly place Northern Palestine is. You understand, talk about Christ's crown of thorns. It is literally covered by shrubs, which are spiky thorns. And you finish a day out in all this terrain, very rocky, sort of limestone, and your arm will come up with blisters, little pussy blisters, where these thorns had turned septic or got turned bad, so you'd be pinching out all the pus. But no, that was actually one of the little hazards.
What did you think of the Bren gun? I mean, that was the thing you were on most, was it?
Well, you had a rifle as well. I wasn't always a Bren gun, but I know I'm one of big ski, I was carrying the brain gun.
It's just,
that's why it's all part of the training.
Now, so what was your next posting then from there?
Well, then, the next thing was that we were posted back to the canal zone in Egypt. to Middle East, is it Middle East Infantry Training Depot, MEITD, Middle East and Infantry Training Depot, where we were going to be posted. And of course, the men that had been trained back in the Middle East, they didn't come to Palestine. And so I'd lost touch completely with my unit. I was now on my own. And my first job was that I got a very good report actually from ACCA, and I was put on staff at the depot
as an instructor. Then.
Yeah. Of course, we got all these gunners to be converted, and having the gunnery background and knowing the type of men I was dealing with, I was given the job of converting them and training them in to infantiers. And my immediate boss was a Major Montgomery, who incidentally was the nephew of Monty, the Monty. And we got on very well together.
Now, how did it go, the training program? I mean, some of them can't have been too keen to be converted to gun.
Well, we did scheme out in the desert, and all sorts of night schemes as well. Using a 2-inch mortar, because 2-inch mortar was part of the Normandy infantryman's weaponry. You had the bearing gun section, you had the mortar section, as part of the infantiers with the riflemen. And it was quite interesting. Also, we used effects an awful lot for noise effects. Using gelatine, we used to make to call the loud explosion, give the battle sort of scene, especially at night time and also during the day. We're using a stick of jelly knife, which you cut in three sections. It's like jelly stuff. Three sections. You had a primer, or a detonator, to get to them, which is highly sensitive because it's got fulminated mercury in it, and you would advise not to rub them, because it could explode and break your hand off. So it's a very sensitive piece of equipment. It's the same thing as we use in the mortar, in the hand grenade, same sort of thing. And you just very gingerly squeeze this detonator into the one end of the jelly knight. But before doing that, you had crimped on a short piece of fuse, about that long, push in there, and you had a bit like a pair of pliers. You just crimped it round so it was crimped into the end of the detonator. And then when you wanted to make a bang, you all had a cigarette on. You lit the end of the fuse from the cigarette, then threw it somewhere in the vicinity of the men. It wouldn't hurt them. It would just make a hell of a bang, blow a bit of desert around. So kept them on the toes.
These are all thunder flashes.
Thunder flash. That's the sort of my trying to think of. Yes.
What else would you do in this period?
We got to use a brain gun carrier for carrying troops around in small.
What did you think of the brain gun carrier?
Oh, quite a nice piece of equipment. You could turn it on six, but you have only the two controls to operate the two sets of tracks.
Was that your introduction yourself to it? I mean, you.
Beg pardon?
Was that the first time you'd encountered the brain gun?
Yes, actually. Although, as an instructor, I was issued with a motorbike. So I used to tutor on my matchless motorbike. We're on schemes and so on. No, it went quite well. Then that dried up. And eventually it came to another posting, you see. And I was informed that I was going to be posted to the Sudanese Defence Force down somewhere in Eritrea or that area.
What do you think of that?
Well, I was very keen. I said, why can't I go to Italy and probably join up with some of my own men? And then Montgomery said, well, look, he said, something here which might interest you. He said, it's a Jewish Brigade Group depot. And I don't suppose many people really realise that there was this Jewish Brigade operating initially with the British forces. And, of course, they had no end of very lots of eager volunteers, of course, knowing how the Germans had sort of massacred the Jews, the Palestinian Jews, and also Jews from all over Europe, were keen to join up. And this was a training area, sort of a training depot.
And where was it?
Always in the same area.
At Canal Zone?
Yeah, Canal Zone, by the Bitter Lakes. Just inland from the Great and Bitter and the Little Bitter Lake.
And this would be, what, 1945 by now?
Early 1945, yeah.
Now, so what were these recruits like? What were they're coming from everywhere.
They're coming from Palestine. Of course, it wasn't Israel then, you see. It wasn't until 1948 that Israel was formed. So they were coming from Palestine. They were coming from Mauritius. They came from the Baltic states. I had French Jews, Italian Jews, Russian Jews. But most of them spoke English, which was a great godsend.
And what were they like as trainee soldiers? I mean, could you...
Very, very good, yeah.
Were they being trained as infantry? Was this infantry?
Pretty infantry, yeah. So just basic training, how to handle a rifle, how to handle grenades, and things of that nature.
And what would happen to them after
and
their training?
Also a little bit on tactics as well. How a platoon would work in holding a certain position.
And what was the plan for the? Well, I mean, when they finished their basic training with you, what
they were then posted to Italy to join the brigade, which was in northern Italy.
This is a Jewish brigade.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what do you remember of this phase?
One thing which that set in my mind was, I told you about my remember that the woman was pregnant.
Oh, the parade. The
identification parade, that's right. I was subject to a second or two further identification parades whilst with them. We were descended upon one day by the Egyptian Narcotics Bureau, a member thereof, plus another commission officer from the SIB, which is the Securities Information Bureau of the British Army, and due to narcotics. And what had happened was that they found the narcotics were being brought across from the Sinai Desert into Egypt and sold them on the market there, and it was being done by British troops. And they'd found out that a certain driver, who was a British driver with the Jewish Brigade, part of the training force, was taking his truck across the Suez Canal into the desert beyond. Normally, all traffic going across would be searched, but British trucks were not. And so he was rendezvousing somewhere and collecting a load of hashish and deliver it to some address in the Cairo area, and being paid £100 a time for doing it, which was quite a lot of money those times. And I don't know how many times he did it, but he thought, well, if I get £100, why not try and sell it myself? So he tried to flog this in the Cairo area, but unfortunately he was trying to sell it to the wrong people. And his cover was blown, and so they descended on the depot. This bomber, he was a lance corporal truck driver. He was arrested, but he was also being working in conjunction with a Jewish officer I had, one of the junior officers working with me, Lieutenant Noyce, who was also involved in it. Also involved was the sergeant in charge of the officers' mess. He had arranged storage under the bar in the officers' mess, behind all the bottles of this slabs of this particular stuff, it hashes in peculiar slabs in polythene and sort of covering. And so he was arrested, and of course everybody was suspect, including myself. So the identification parades from people from Cairo, and they sorted out the end who was guilty, and that was the end of the story. But bit unsettling.
Now, were you aware, did you have any thoughts as to whether some of the people you were training might end up on the other side, in the sense that, you know, there already started to be trouble in Israel, well, Palestine, with the Jewish community?
Well, no, they had no trouble of that nature, because it had really highlighted. Of course, you see, with the Palestine police force, you had Arabs and Jews as members of the police force working side by side. So there wasn't that sort of antipathy between the two.
Now, what happened next then? How long were you doing this for, or any particular incidents?
Well, that was until I was received notice of repatriation.
Now, do you remember the end of the war in Europe? I mean, you'd have been out there.
Oh, yes, we did. We did have a little celebration.
How did you first hear?
We first heard about it and thought, well, we'd celebrate, and so we had a bit of a feast day. We had a donkey derby race. Of course, plenty of donkeys in Egypt. Everyone who had any money had a donkey, and you all saw the father of the house riding on the donkey with his wife walking behind. But so we hired about a dozen donkeys, I think it was, and we had a donkey derby. And luckily, one of the NCOs, who actually was Jewish, his name was Cohen, was a bookmaker, so he ran a book on it, and it was really quite a bit of a fun day.
How did you feel about the end of the war? I mean, you know, well, the end of war in Europe.
Yeah, but just before we come to that, one little point, there was some little trouble. These chaps from Israel, these recruits being trained, they were given certain a few days leave to go back to Israel, and it worked quite well until the system broke down. And said, right, you can't be trusted, so all leave was cancelled. And that did cause an uproar. There wasn't, not exactly a mutiny, but they showed dissent. And what it was done, it was quite clever, by drawings. And the crowning piece was, we found in the mess hall one morning, this big picture on the wall of a figure of Pharaoh, and the face was of the CO of the unit, who we think probably liked to drink, because he had rather a sort of red nose. The picture showed his nose and face as Pharaoh's head, and underneath, and Pharaoh would not let the children of Israel go out of Egypt. I wish I could have got it. Yeah, it was quite something.
And there was a series of these drawings.
Oh yes, all about the same theme, you know.
And how did you feel about the end of the war? I mean, was it, were you relieved, or did you think you'd get involved?
Yes, I wanted to get back and get it. No, I actually, I was wondering when I, you know, to go back into my old job, because I had maintained contact after the war with Major Whiting, my first one of the first CEOs, but that was actually happened after I got back home. But I wondered whether I wanted to go back to an office job.
Hang on, we'll come on to that. Yeah. But what about when you were out there? Yeah. I mean, what were you looking forward to, DMOB?
Oh yes, rather. We went to Alexandria, and we were awaiting a ship to take us home from there.
Now, when was this?
That was in October.
October 45.
45, yeah.
And what about the trip back?
One thing I forgot to mention, that when I was up in Tripoli, my twin daughters were born. I knew, I'd heard from my wife by mail that she was pregnant, but didn't know that it was a question of twins. And I remember the colonel was visiting I was in the headquarters unit at the time at Tripoli, and visiting, and the colonel was there, and the news came through. It was one of these cablegrams, which they were using, twins born, quoting the dates and so forth, two daughters, and it was a bit expensive. They had a round of drinks all around the colonel and all the other officers and so forth, but yes, that was quite something.